From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Government officials and government action are not for sale. The Justice Department will aggressively investigate and prosecute these types of cases, which have a devastating impact on the public's trust of government.
Top Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff has pleaded guilty to 3 felony counts and admitted to defrauding millions from Native American tribes. Today, we look at what's being described as possibly the biggest congressional scandal in over a century. Abramoff is reportedly prepared to implicate up to 60 lawmakers in a massive corruption scandal.
I think that the Abramoff investigation is something that really has the potential of changing the culture in Congress when members of Congress see their colleagues being brought into court, potentially going to jail. I think everyone's going to take a hard look at their behavior.
And we'll take a look at a little-known part of Abramoff's lobbying career, his ties to the tiny South Pacific island of Saipan, where sweatshop workers were held as indentured servants and female employees were forced to have abortions. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 12 of the 13 coal miners trapped in a West Virginia mine are dead. The announcement was made early this morning, just hours after authorities falsely reported all but one of the miners had been found alive. Randall McCloy, the lone person to survive the explosion, has been hospitalized in critical condition. This is Ben Hatfield, president and CEO of the International Coal Group.
The initial report from the rescue team to the command center indicated multiple survivors, but that information proved to be a miscommunication. The only confirmed survivor is Randall L. McCloy, Jr., who has now been rushed to a local hospital in serious condition. The 11 remaining miners in the barricade structure were determined by the medical technicians on the rescue team to have already deceased.
The miners had been trapped at least 260 feet beneath the surface since early Monday. The mine's owned by the Kentucky-based International Coal Group, which was cited for over 200 health and safety violations last year, including 21 citations for the dangerous buildup of combustible material. In Washington Tuesday, the prominent Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff pleaded guilty to 3 felony counts. He admitted to defrauding at least 4 Native American tribes of tens of millions of dollars, bribing government officials, and evading taxes. Abramoff has reportedly agreed to testify against several members of Congress who receive favors or donations from him or his clients. The Wall Street Journal reports his testimony could implicate as many as 60 lawmakers. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The Bush administration is launching a new push for the renewal of the Patriot Act before it expires early next month. Congress granted the act a temporary extension 2 weeks ago amid bipartisan concerns its renewal lacks adequate safeguards for civil liberties. This is President Bush speaking Tuesday.
There's oversight on this important program. And now when it came time to renew the act, for partisan reasons, in my mind, people have not stepped up and have agreed that it's still necessary to protect the country. The enemy has not gone away. They're still there. And I expect Congress to understand that we're still at war, and they've got to give us the tools necessary to win this war.
In other news, the Justice Department has filed a request to dismiss more than 180 cases brought by Guantanamo Bay detainees to challenge their detentions. The prisoners lost their right to habeas corpus in a Senate amendment attached to anti-torture legislation passed last month. Prisoners are now only able to plead their case before an appeals court once they've gone through a military court process. Newly declassified documents suggest the National Security Agency stepped up domestic surveillance efforts in the weeks after 9/11, even before it received a formal directive from President Bush. On Tuesday, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi released an exchange of letters showing both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees were briefed in October 2001 about the agency's attempts to loosen restrictions on domestic eavesdropping. However, domestic wiretaps do not appear to have occurred until President Bush ordered the secret domestic spy program in 2002. In Latin America, Bolivia's president-elect, Evo Morales, was in Caracas to meet with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez Tuesday. This is Evo Morales.
Estamos en nueva...
We are in a new age. We are in a new millennium, a millennium for the people and not for the empire, a millennium to resolve social problems, economic problems. This is not only in Bolivia, but Fidel in Cuba, Hugo in Venezuela, continuing the triumphs of social movements of the left-wing political parties in the national majorities.
Bolivian President Evo Morales. Morales will take office on January 22nd with the most popular support of any president in decades. Morales stopped in Venezuela as part of an inaugural seven-country tour. The tour does not include the United States, where Morales says he has yet to be invited. In Argentina, the government announced Tuesday it's paid off the entirety of a nearly $10 billion debt to the International Monetary Fund. Argentina borrowed over $13 billion following a devastating economic collapse in December 2001, a collapse many Argentines blamed on economic policies encouraged by the IMF. In Mexico, the Zapatista rebel army has launched a six-month tour of poor and indigenous communities across Mexico. The Zapatistas have dubbed the tour the Other Campaign, a reference to the run-up to the country's presidential elections in July. The group says it'll not take part in the elections, but is using the tour to help promote a shift away from armed conflict and towards the formation of a nationwide leftist political movement. Zapatista leader Marcos also announced he's dropping Subcomandante from his name in favor of Delegate Zero, saying he no longer wants to take on a military title. This is Marcos speaking to thousands of supporters in Palenque on Tuesday.
The governments that we have, aside from lying to us and robbing from us, taking what little we have, they put high prices on what we buy. And for the things we produce as farmers or as workers, they pay a pittance.
Zapatista leader Marcos, formerly subcomandante in Palenque Tuesday. In Peru, the government has asked Chile for the extradition of former President Alberto Fujimori. Fujimori faces several corruption and human rights charges stemming from his decade as president in the 90s. He was detained when he arrived in Chile in November. The charges include the killing of political opponents, illegal phone tapping, and bribery. In other news, the prominent American organization Human Rights Watch has called on the Bush administration to cut back foreign aid to Israel. In a letter to President Bush, Human Rights Watch asked Bush to deduct from Israel's foreign aid assistance the amount it spends on expansion of settlements and the separation wall in the West Bank. Israel's the largest annual recipient of U.S. foreign aid, with direct assistance and loans exceeding $5 billion in 2005. Human Rights Watch officials said their request marks the first time a major human rights group has asked for an actual cut in direct aid to Israel. In Indonesia, hundreds of people are feared to be dead following a landslide that's buried dozens of homes in a village in the country's central Java. Authorities say the bodies of 16 people have already been recovered in the village of Sijiruk. The landslide slammed into the village Tuesday following days of monsoon rains that have already killed at least 60 people and left thousands homeless. Environmental groups say the disasters have been worsened by rampant deforestation caused by unregulated logging and farming. And in breaking news, a suicide bomber has killed at least 30 people in a Shiite funeral procession in Iraq. The bombing occurred in Muqtadidiyya, a town northeast of Baghdad. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We now turn to what's being described as possibly the biggest congressional scandal in over a century. On Tuesday, the prominent Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff pleaded guilty to three felony counts. He admitted to defrauding at least four Native American tribes of tens of millions of dollars, bribing government officials, and evading taxes. Abramoff has reportedly agreed to testify against several members of Congress who receive favors or donations from him or his clients. Washington analysts say the corruption scandal could take down as many as 12 lawmakers, but Abramoff's ties reached to all parts of Washington. He became a Washington lobbyist after the Republicans won control of the House in 94. He played a key role in what was called the K Street Project, a Republican attempt to essentially take control of the D.C. lobbying world. By 95, he would befriend Tom DeLay, who would later call Abramoff, quote, one of his closest and dearest friends. He became a key fundraiser for President Bush, served on Bush's transition team in 2000. His former assistant became Karl Rove's personal assistant. He was accused of offering congressional staffers lucrative jobs in exchange for legislative help. Abramoff ordered lobbying clients to give millions in political contributions to key lawmakers. The Wall Street Journal reports Abramoff could implicate as many as 60 lawmakers in the corruption inquiry. On Tuesday, Alice Fisher, the Assistant Attorney General of the Criminal Division of the Justice Department, announced Abramoff had pleaded guilty.
Government officials and government action are not for sale. The Justice Department will aggressively investigate and prosecute these types of cases, which have a devastating impact on the public's trust of government. We will not shy away from that responsibility, no matter where the trail leads. I will note that while Abramoff engaged in the business of lobbying, his activities went far beyond lawful lobbying to the illegal practice of paying for official acts. Lawful lobbying does not include paying a public official a personal benefit with the understanding, explicit or implicit, that a certain official act will occur. That's not lobbying, that's a crime.
Assistant Attorney General Alice Fisher. Today we spend the hour examining the rise and fall of Jack Abramoff and examining the state of lobbying in Washington. Later in the show, we'll speak with a Native American tribal leader built of millions of dollars from Abramoff and his business partner, Michael Scanlon, the former Tom DeLay press aide. We'll also speak with former Colorado Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell, who chaired the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs when the Abramoff scandal first broke. But we begin with Peter Stone, staff reporter for the National Journal. He's been writing about Jack Abramoff extensively for years. Welcome to Democracy Now, Peter.
Nice to be with you. Thanks.
Well, why don't you start off by just laying out the scope of what Jack Abramoff, Michael Scanlon were involved with?
Well, based on what we've learned over the last year in Senate hearings that Ben Nighthorse Campbell and Senator McCain were instrumental in starting, that looked into the allegations that they bilked tribes of tens of millions of dollars, and now what's come out in not only Abramoff's plea bargain yesterday, but Scanlon's plea bargain, and what are expected to be more in the near future, the scope of the fraud appears to be enormous. One of Abramoff's former partners apparently referred to it at one point when the scandal was about to break or just broken as potentially the Enron of lobbying, which is not a bad analogy in some ways. The scandal is now really shaken up both the lobbying community in Washington and members and congressional staffers who were close to Jack Abramoff or even who knew him very slightly and who worked with him. What we've seen really is a pattern of favor giving, a pattern of influence peddling that, as Alice Fisher said, appears to go well beyond the lawful bounds of lobbying. And Abramoff delighted in being extravagant. He delighted in excess. And the kind of influence machine that he built in Washington involved not only lawful campaign contributions, but in conjunction with lawful campaign contributions from members and staffers who he was trying to win help from, he would do just about everything imaginable in the way of currying favor, from taking good friends like Tom DeLay and Bob Ney on golfing junkets to Scotland, to trips to the Marianas, another major client of Abramoff's that goes back to the late mid-90s when he first broke into lobbying. These are the island territories that depend heavily on sweatshop labor, cheap immigrant labor, and Abramoff's role was to ensure that these islands were not subject to minimum wage laws, U.S. minimum wage laws, that the territory did not have to impose. And he was successful in that, and he was successful with a lot with the help of key GOP allies in Congress, notably Mr. DeLay, was the major champion of the effort to stave off minimum wage laws. But beyond trips like these for members and staffers, and I should note influential conservatives who he took on junkets too, some of the junkets, which again began in the 90s when he was focusing on the Marianas and his first Indian client, the Choctaws, included conservatives who worked with major think tanks in Washington, the Heritage Foundation, Americans for Tax Reform, which was led by Jack's old dear friend Grover Norquist, who he'd once run college Republicans with in the early 80s. And there were other gifts, too. Jack went on to set up two big restaurants in Washington, one of which in 202 became a hotspot for dining for folks from Capitol Hill. Lobbyists, lawmakers came to his restaurant Signatures, where he was well known for offering some of his best friends free food and meals. There were fundraisers there, many, many fundraisers, mostly Republican fundraisers. But Jack is the scope of what he built as an influence machine has been really unrivaled in Washington. And it now appears, based on the allegations that we're seeing and Abramoff's plea agreement, which promises his cooperation against a wide variety of folks who he acknowledges he conspired to bribe, promises to produce a scandal that will be the biggest, at least in a generation, and could be bigger than that.
We're talking to Peter Stone, the correspondent for National Journal. How did Jack Abramoff get his start, and what about his relationship with Tom DeLay?
Well, Jack broke into lobbying in 1995, right at the point when the Republicans captured Congress for the first time in 40 years. And unlike many lobbyists who start, he did not have government background. He did not have the kind of Hill experience that either as a member or a former aide or administration experience. But he had been a key Republican activist going back to the early 80s when he ran College Republicans right after he got out of Brandeis. The man who helped him ran his campaign when he went on to become chairman in the early 80s was Grover Norquist, who he'd known from the Reagan campaign in 1980 when they worked together to help Reagan capture the state of Massachusetts. And Jack also built a close relationship with another key conservative in those years who went on to fame, and that's Ralph Reed, who was the third of a group of conservatives, a sort of a troika at College Republicans, who by 1995 had emerged as powerful allies of both Speaker Gingrich and Tom DeLay when the Republicans captured Congress. And I think it was Norquist and Reed who in part gave him a jump start as a lobbyist in Washington, access to members on the Hill that made his rise rather quick. And he also had contacts through fundraising very early on with DeLay. He became a principal fundraiser. He did other things with DeLay. He started cultivating his staff, who went on later to become allies of Jack. Scanlon was a press aide to DeLay in the late 90s. And when he left Congress in 2000, he joined Jack at one firm and then a second firm and then in a separate venture as his public relations specialist, his grassroots specialist. Jack also forged ties with two of DeLay's top aides, Ed Buckham, who was DeLay's chief of staff, and Tony Rudy, his deputy chief of staff, both of whom went on to be allies as well. So there were multiple links to DeLay that became important in Jack's career. And, obviously DeLay is one of the members on Hill who is nervous about where this investigation may lead, although his press spokesman and lawyer have said he has nothing to fear and is urging people to cooperate with the investigation.
Peter Stone, the Wall Street Journal is reporting up to 60 lawmakers could be implicated by Jack Abramoff.
I don't think we know for sure. I think the more conservative estimates, what I've written and what other papers have written in the last few weeks, is maybe six or so lawmakers under close scrutiny. I think there's a wider number that are probably being looked at, but I think the justice probe and multi-agency task force that's looking at this are not looking for individual cases of a campaign contribution or one gift per se that might link up closely with a legislative favor or some kind of action. I think they're focusing on people such as Bob Ney, who was referred to in the plea bargain yesterday as representative number one. He's not named per se, but is clearly the member who is first and foremost under scrutiny by the Justice Department now. He was referred to in Scanlon's plea bargain as well. And what you have here with Ney is a pattern of gifts and favors from Abramoff and Scanlon, including campaign contributions, including a golf trip, including meals, including other things as well, that were followed by or preceded by various kinds of favors. Ney entered two very unusual statements in the Congressional Record in 2000 at a time when Abramoff was seeking to buy a casino line down in Florida called Sun Cruise. And Ney, who's, of course, a representative from Ohio, put statements in the record early in 2000 that sharply criticized the man who was then running the casino for some reason. Didn't seem to be totally relevant or relevant at all to his district, but he took he did make a statement then criticizing this fellow who Abramoff and his partners at the time were trying to buy the casino from. And then shortly after the purchase went through, Ney went back and put another statement in the Congressional Record praising one of Abramoff's partners who just bought the casino. And despite his rather checkered past, which included being disbarred from the practice of law in New York and a bankrupt business that he had in Washington, credited him with tremendous skills and said he would try to probably be able to turn the enterprise around.
And didn't ultimately one of these men die in a gangland-style murder?
The man they bought the casino from, Gus Boulos, they quickly fell into disagreement with him as when the purchase was being negotiated and consummated. Boulos was gunned down in a gangland-style slaying in Florida in February of 2001. And three men were finally arrested in that case and charged with murder several months ago. Two of these men had been hired by Abramoff's partner, Adam Kadan, to serve as caterers and provide security to the Sun Cruise after the purchase went through. Abramoff is, I believe, due in court today in Florida to enter a plea there because he's also faced charges there over fraudulent purchase. He and Kadan put up reportedly a phony $23 million note to buy as the initial payment on Sun Cruise, and he was charged in August with wire fraud and mail fraud in that case as well. So he has got a rather long list of frauds that he's been accused of. There were three counts in Washington yesterday, including tax evasion, fraud, and conspiracy to bribe public officials that carry a maximum penalty of 30 years. It's been reported that he's likely to face something on the order of 10 years after sentencing guidelines are worked out. And he's been has to cooperate fully and provide evidence against public officials, who he's been talking to justice about now for months. And while the only public member of Congress named in the plea bargain yesterday was Ney, it's thought that he has talked about a number of other members who he worked with closely, probably more than half a dozen. But once again, I suspect that they're really focusing in on half a dozen now. It could broaden, certainly. It could include a dozen or more. There are Hill staffers who are being looked at very, very closely. Two were identified yesterday, who later became lobbying partners of Mr. Abramoff's. One was Ney's chief of staff, Neil Voles, who helped to, as a point of access for Abramoff when he was trying to get Ney's support, and then who turned around and went to work for Abramoff in 2002 and helped again going as a lobbyist and lobbying partner for Abramoff. The other one mentioned yesterday, again, not by name. These are not Voles was not named, but only referred to as Staffer B. Staffer A in the plea agreement was Tony Rudy, who was former deputy chief of staff to Tom DeLay. So they're clearly looking at former aides who helped Jack when they were on the Hill, several of whom went on to become his lobbying partners, which is a fascinating and key part of the influence-peddling machine that he set up in Washington.
Well, Peter Stone, we have to leave it there. Staff correspondent for the National Journal has covered Abramoff lobbying scandal for the past years. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. Jack Rose here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to take a closer look at who benefited from their ties to Jack Abramoff inside Congress. The Wall Street Journal's reporting Abramoff says he's information that could implicate 60 lawmakers. One Republican lawmaker, Congressman Robert Ney of Ohio, has already been subpoenaed. But many other Republicans face possible corruption inquiries, including former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay and House Speaker Dennis Hastert. Some Democrats, including Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, have also received donations from clients of Abramoff. While Abramoff has been a lifelong Republican activist, the White House is attempting to paint the scandal as a bipartisan affair. This is a clip from Tuesday's White House press briefing with Scott McClellan.
A Republican lobbyist, Jack Abramoff, is pleaded guilty to fraud, corruption, and tax evasion here in the federal court in Washington. Already the DNC has put out a statement essentially saying that this is another example of what they are calling the culture of corruption and abuse of power that have been the hallmarks of the Bush administration.
Well, I've seen press reports that indicate that he and his clients have given to both Democrats and Republicans. So that's the first thing that I would say. Secondly, I'm not sure if he's actually entered a plea at this point, but the wrongdoing that he apparently now is acknowledging he was involved in is outrageous. And if he broke laws, he needs to be held to account and he needs to be punished. And beyond that, I think we'd just be speculating about things at this point. I'm not going to engage in speculation. Go ahead, April.
White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. Advocates for campaign finance are warning the Abramoff scandal is only the tip of a more widespread problem in Washington. This is Shelley Pengree, president of the watchdog group Common Cause.
Given the web of his engagement and his involvement, there's a lot of things people have to be worried about. There are certainly members of Congress themselves who are concerned that they will be implicated in having taken money, whether it was campaign contributions or gifts, from Jack Abramoff and his clients and done something in return. But then the net goes much further. There are people who are working in members of Congress's office and the executive branch and the private sector, associates of his, members of the communities that gave money to members of Congress. It looks like this scandal is going to go very far. I don't think anyone does buy, you know, one single vote or every decision for a dinner. But the cumulative influence of every night a different dinner and a different set of lobbyists and a golfing trip and making sure your staff is, you know, taken to a casino or, you know, just the spread of this influence permeates the decision-making process here. And you have to step back again and say, does the average citizen get to sit down with a member of Congress and let them know how they feel about health care or education or the war in Iraq? And if not, then why should somebody who's able to buy them a $150 dinner have that level of access and influence?
Shelley Pengree of the Washington Watch Group Common Cause to review which lawmakers have been implicated in the Abramoff scandal. We're joined now in our Washington studio by Judd Legum, Director of Research at the Center for American Progress. Welcome, Judd.
Thanks for having me.
Can you go through the list?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a long list, and I think it's depends on how you define it. But I think if you look particularly, you've got most of the involvement among Republicans in the House. And you could start at the top with Dennis Hassert, who you've mentioned, who held fundraisers at Jack Abramoff's restaurant, who received money for him, and in the end was involved in a lot of efforts involving Indian tribes that he generally wasn't involved with in the past before these donations started flowing in. Of course, you have Tom DeLay, whose close associations with Abramoff are well known, once described Abramoff as his closest friend. But then beyond those two, you have a long list of people in the House of Representatives who also had very extensive ties. You have Bob Ney, who's been named, not by name, but referred to in these indictments. Clearly some very questionable, if not blatantly illegal actions on behalf of Ney, and I think he's in for a rough road. But when you go beyond those three, there actually are a lot of other people who could potentially be facing problems. You have people like J.D. Hayworth, who have been guests at Abramoff's Skybox at the MCI Center here in Washington, who have also been doing things on behalf of clients. You have somebody like John Doolittle, who not only received money from Abramoff, who not only was involved in doing favors for Abramoff clients, but whose wife was actually working for Abramoff, raising money for some of these front nonprofit groups who are really a vital piece to this whole influence regime that Abramoff set up, getting money in, tax-exempt money, funneling it both for himself to build homes, to build other, and then also to curry favor with lobbyists to send them on trips, etc. So it's quite an extensive list, and it's quite an extensive number of ties.
Judd, what about Byron Dorgan, the Democrats, he of North Dakota, and the minority leader in the Senate, Harry Reid?
Well, I think they are both in a list where it's really up in the air at this point as to whether what they did was appropriate or not. You certainly have two things there. You have donations that they received from Abramoff's clients. No money from Abramoff. Abramoff didn't directly give any money to Democrats, but they received money from his clients. And you also have them doing activities that benefited Abramoff's clients. Now, on behalf of Byron Dorgan, what he says is that, look, I supported these policies before the money ever came in. And so maybe that'll hold up when this is given closer scrutiny. But at this point, we don't know.
Judd Legum is Director of Research, Center for American Progress, as we turn now to the Native American tribes that have been embroiled in the Jack Abramoff scandal. Yesterday, Abramoff admitted to defrauding four Indian tribe clients out of millions of dollars. Those tribes include the Louisiana Coushatta, the Mississippi Choctaws, the Saginaw Chippewas of Michigan, and the Tigua of Isleta del Sur Pueblo in Texas. The tribes hired Abramoff to represent them in Washington regarding casino and gambling issues. As their lobbyist, Abramoff instructed the tribes to make political donations to certain politicians and recommended they hire a former aide of Tom DeLay named Michael Scanlon as their publicist. Scanlon charged hugely inflated rates. What Abramoff didn't tell the tribes was that Scanlon was secretly his business partner, and that in some cases, Abramoff was also working for groups with competing policy goals. In all, Abramoff and Scanlon received more than $66 million of fees. Some of this money was secretly diverted to a variety of Abramoff's personal projects, including an Orthodox Jewish academy and an Israeli sniper school. Some money also went to pay off a personal debt. In 2002, Abramoff and Scanlon quietly worked with conservative religious activist Ralph Reed to persuade the state of Texas to shut down the Tigua tribe's Standing Rock Casino on the grounds that the casino violated Texas's limited gambling laws. Abramoff then went to the Tiguas and promised to use his influence to reopen the casino, charging the tribe $4.2 million. Meanwhile, Abramoff and Scanlon collected millions of dollars from a Louisiana tribe to oppose all gaming in the Texas legislature. They didn't like the competition. During the 2004 Senate Indian Affairs Committee hearing, emails were made public in which Abramoff referred to tribal members as troglodytes and morons. In one email released by the Senate committee, Abramoff wrote to Scanlon, quote, "I have to meet with the monkeys from Choctaw Tribal Council." Former Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell was chair of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee in 2004 when it took up investigating Abramoff. Campbell wrote in a statement at the time, quote, "It's a story of greed run amok. It's a story of two already powerful, wealthy men lining their own pockets with the hard-earned money of people whom they held in contempt and disregard." Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell joins us on the phone right now from Durango, the former senator. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy. How are you?
It's good to have you with us. Your response to the plea bargain of
Well, I think justice will be served. The investigation has been going on some time. I, along with Senator McCain, started the hearings when I was still in office, and we did the first two of them together, and then he's carried on with them. And even during that time, the FBI was doing their own investigation. So I think eventually the Justice Department will sort it all out. I think the thing that bothers me the most is that Indian tribes have been pulled into this thing so that a lot of people lose track of the fact that they were victimized themselves. They were not partners to some kind of a crime that Abramoff was involved in. And what it has done is it created sort of a backlash in Congress where now a lot of our members are running pell-mell away from Indian tribes, which denies them the right that everybody else has, which is to have a voice in their own future through the political process. And that's, to me, what's really sad. But these two guys are bad guys. There's no question about it. I never have met Mr. Abramoff and never got any money from him, never sat in any skybox, took any trips, did all that stuff that some of my colleagues are accused of. But I'm told by former staffers that and they reminded me that at one time he did try to come and see me when I was in office, when I was the chairman. And they advised me at that time not to meet with him because they said he was a rather suspicious guy and pretty slick, as I remember the word that they used. And so I never would meet with him. But clearly he did meet with a number of other colleagues on both sides of the aisles.
We are also joined, in addition to former U.S. Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell of Colorado, by Arturo Sinclair, the governor of the Tigua Vizleta del Sur Pueblo tribe in El Paso, Texas. Can you explain what happened to the Tigua?
Well, it was back in 2002, and that was the time that the federal judge of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, federal judge Isley, he issued the court order for us to be shut down Speaking Rock Casino. Here in El Paso, Texas. Abramoff came in shortly after that, about a month later, and he says, "Look, guys, I've got the perfect solution. I'm going to go ahead and be able to pass legislation for you all to be reopened up again." We did our checks on Abramoff again, you know, through the internet, through our other sources, and we saw that he had done good work for the Mississippi Choctaw, and we didn't know at the time that he was working for the Louisiana Cachadas, who, as former Senator Gamble was saying, that they oppose the competition on the east side of Texas in regards to gaming. So what happened was Abramoff came in, and he says, "I've got the perfect solution." Again, unknown that he had used Ralph Reed to shut us down.
Now, Ralph Reed lobbied bringing together religious leaders, saying that they were simply opposed to gambling.
What Ralph Reed did through Abramoff, Ralph Reed put the pressure on the back then former Attorney General John Cornyn, now Senator. He put the pressure through the Christian Coalition to push the effort for the closure, that it was ill and evil and we need to stop gaming in the state of Texas.
Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell, your response.
Well, I agree with the chairman. You know, there have been a time or two, there's no question about it, that some tribes have opposed others. They have huge investments in those casinos, and they worry about their own returns on their investments deteriorating if there's competition across the street, so to speak. But from a broader picture, I think your listeners need to know that out of something like 557 recognized tribes in America, less than half have casinos. And out of the half that do have casinos, in my view, there's only about 10% that are what we would call super successful, making these huge dollars a year, when the vast majority of Indian people are still dirt poor and struggling every day to try to get an education for their kids or to try to make ends meet from a financial standpoint. I tried to have a rule when I was in office, though, because I am Indian myself. I thought the tribes should have the right to see me directly without an intermediary through a lobbyist. So I just, through the staff, would always tell them, ask the chairman or ask the tribal council to come in themselves and tell me what I can do to help them and not send in a professional voice for themselves. But he... This thing, when you talk about what is being talked about now, that we need some kind of broad reform in Congress, I'd remind people that we had a broad reform, quote-unquote, after Watergate. Then we had broad reform a couple of years ago under McCain-Feingold. There always seems to be a loophole or a way if people are not of good heart and good spirit to circumvent the process. But I still believe that tribes were really more innocent victims than they were a party to anything that was done that was inappropriate.
At that hearing, Senator Neidhart Campbell, you read the emails out loud. You read the reference to the Native American tribes, troglodytes, morons.
Yeah.
These are the people, of course, that are paying these men.
Yes. I might tell you, too, that Mr. Abramoff is Jewish, and I've always had a very close feeling for Jewish people because I know the history of what they've gone through in the world, through the Holocaust and so many other things. And I remember asking him in committee under oath, I said, how could you, a person that is of Jewish background, who knows what your own people have gone through, how could you take advantage of another people who have gone through many of the same things? I mean, there are some Indian people, you know, that call the days from Columbus up to now as the 400-year Holocaust. I mean, I've heard that referred to it. So they've done their share of suffering, and I couldn't believe that a person like Abramoff, whose ancestry is Jewish, could get involved in something like that. But unfortunately, he took the fifth on me on every question I asked him. He simply wouldn't answer.
Senator, in your statement as chair of the Committee on Indian Affairs in 2004 in the oversight hearing on tribal lobbying matters, you said, I must say the allegation that most concerns me is that Mr. Abramoff and Mr. Scanlon may have tried to manipulate the outcomes of tribal elections for their own personal profit. You said our investigation has found that in at least two instances, Abramoff and Scanlon sought to profit by becoming involved in attempting to manipulate tribal elections. They helped elect council members at no charge, but apparently with the understanding that they would be compensated later.
Yes, that's true. It's called election rigging, and it's a federal offense. And that was my understanding from the research that we had done and our investigators had done, that they had got involved with at least two tribes and tried to rig the election by doing advertising for the candidates they wanted to win and generating some opposition to the ones that they wanted to lose with a kind of a quid pro quo understanding that if the ones they got elected won, they would get some kind of return favor, a lobbying favor. If any Indian people entered that agreement knowingly, then they should also be held accountable, I think, because nobody should affect a tribal election except tribal members, in my view.
Arturo Sinclair and Ben Neidhart Campbell. In 2002 alone, records show three Indian tribes donated nearly $1.1 million to the Capital Athletic Foundation. That's Abramoff's foundation. But now Newsweek has learned investigators probing Abramoff's finances have found some of the money meant for inner city kids went instead to fight the Palestinian Intifada. More than $140,000 of foundation funds were actually sent to the Israeli West Bank, where they were used by a Jewish settler to mobilize against the Palestinian uprising. Among the expenditures, purchases of camouflage suits, sniper scopes, night vision binoculars, a thermal imager, and other material described in foundation records as security equipment. The FBI sources tell Newsweek is now examining these payments as part of a larger investigation to determine if Abramoff defrauded his Indian tribe clients.
Well, he probably did. But, you know, there are already laws on the books that allow tribes to recover some of their losses. And as I understand it, the Tiguas have already filed a lawsuit to try to recover some of the money that they gave him. I understand also, though, that he's now saying he's broke, that he did something with it, gave it away or some darn thing. So who knows? They may never recover their losses, but they're certainly going to come out of this whole experience a heck of a wiser and be a lot more careful on the people that they ask to carry their voice to Washington.
Arturo Sinclair, can you explain what you have asked for in terms of getting your money back for the Tigua Vizlata del Sur Pueblo tribe?
We're working with the Greenberg Traurig law firm. That's one of the agreements that we did establish. We did do a partial settlement with the law firm. We are seeking the civil remedy on this. But let me just point out one other issue in regards to Abramoff, to what extent the greed came in. He approached us in mid-2003, and he says, look, guys, do you all have some tribal members that are above 75 years of age? I'd like to be able to buy insurance policies on them. He would pay the premiums, and he would be the beneficiary. That's unheard of in our culture. We just don't do that, but that's the extreme of the greed that he came to. We as a council told him that's unheard of. It's not going to be held. But he still proposed it one more time just to see if he could get the insurance policies on our elders.
Arturo Sinclair, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Governor of the Tigua of Isleta del Sur Pueblo Tribe in Texas, and former Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell, thank you for joining us from Durango, former chair of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we go to the South Pacific island of Saipan. What does Jack Abramoff, Tom DeLay, and the South Pacific island have in common? Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Controversy is nothing new to Jack Abramoff. The Los Angeles Times reports Abramoff's first political scandal dates back to 1972 when he ran for student council president at the Hawthorne School, an elementary and middle school in Beverly Hills, California. Abramoff was reportedly disqualified for exceeding the spending limit in the race. In college, Abramoff teamed up with two students who would become household names in Washington to take over the College Republican National Committee. They were anti-tax crusader Grover Norquist and Ralph Reed, founder of the Christian Coalition. After college, Abramoff's resume was diverse, from his brief Hollywood career to his secret dealings with the South African apartheid regime. In a 95 investigation by Newsday, it revealed that Abramoff helped run a think tank called the International Freedom Foundation. The organization was set up in 1986, its goal to improve the white South African apartheid government's image in the West while demonizing Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress as communist tools. The Newsday report also quoted sources saying the South African military helped finance the 1988 movie Red Scorpion, which Abramoff wrote and produced. The movie was a sympathetic portrayal of an anti-communist African guerrilla commander and loosely based on Jonas Savimbi, the Angolan rebel leader who is an ally of both South Africa's apartheid government and the U.S. government. Well, we turn now to Abramoff's special relationship with the South Pacific island of Saipan and how it connects to his ties to House Majority Leader, former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. Saipan's an American territory in the South Pacific, also known as the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. In the mid-90s, Abramoff was on the payroll of Saipan officials aiming to stop legislation that would crack down on sweatshop conditions run rampant on the island. In 97, Abramoff arranged a lavish trip to the island of Saipan for Tom DeLay. The DeLay trip was originally reported by Brian Ross, the chief investigative correspondent for ABC News. We're going to play two excerpts from the report, which aired on ABC's 2020, March 13, 1998. In this first excerpt, Ross interviews Ellen Stayman, a Clinton administration official in the Department of Interior who is investigating labor conditions in Saipan. And Brian Ross also talks to a worker in one of the factories and ends with Eric Gregoire, a human rights worker with the Department of the Interior. Most of the workers in these factories are from mainland China.
In fact, American authorities have discovered many Chinese workers are forced to sign secret agreements known as shadow contracts before they leave China, severely and in some ways illegally restricting their activities while on American soil. For example, in this agreement, translated into English by American authorities, workers are forbidden to participate in any religious or political activity, or to ask for a salary increase, or even to fall in love or get married, much as might be the case in mainland China.
To allow them to bring that onto U.S. soil is a very deep concern. We've now documented the fact that management coerces female workers who become pregnant into having abortions.
Several of the cases the government says it's documented were at this factory, the one with the contract to make Ralph Lauren polo T-shirts. This Chinese woman, Tu Xiao Mei, made T-shirts and pants at the factory until she became pregnant.
When I told them I was pregnant, they tell me to have an abortion.
Tu Xiao Mei says she refused to have the abortion and has now been barred from entering the factory.
And are you going to have your baby?
Yes.
Will you get your job back then?
Cannot get her job back, she says.
We want to ask you about the abortions. Do you know about the complaint?
No.
The bosses at the factory said they didn't want to talk about what they called ridiculous allegations. But human rights workers say it's common practice at this factory and others.
With 11,000 Chinese workers here, I have never seen a Chinese garment factory worker have a baby in my entire 4 years on Saipan.
There are no children in those barracks?
No. Inside that factory, Chinese law applies. And Chinese law is supreme.
Even though it's the United States of America.
That's right. The flag doesn't fly inside there.
And that was Eric Gregoire, a human rights worker, who was talking to Brian Ross. This next excerpt also from Brian Ross's report on ABC's 2020, which aired in 98. This clip deals with Tom DeLay's connection to Saipan. Brian Ross again speaks with the human rights activist Eric Gregoire.
Saipan has cultivated some powerful friends back in Washington, spending millions of dollars on lobbyists and free trips in the middle of the winter for members of Congress and their staff. Congressman Tom DeLay of Houston, the third-ranking Republican in the House, went as a guest of the Saipan government over the Christmas holiday, a trip that included a tour of several factories and barracks, with one that even Congressman DeLay had to concede was nothing to write home about.
But you know, this trip has been very beneficial.
Still, at a fancy New Year's Eve dinner thrown in his honor, DeLay praised the outgoing governor and vowed to fight efforts back in Washington to change Saipan's immigration and labor laws.
Because you are a shining light for what is happening in the Republican Party, and you represent everything that is good about what we're trying to do in America, in leading the world in the free market system.
And DeLay is just one of more than 80 influential congressmen and congressional staff members who have been brought out to Saipan. Most put up, as was DeLay, at the beachfront Hyatt Regency, about as far from the island sweatshops as it is possible to get on Saipan.
They're paying your way, so of course you're going to see what they want you to see.
They haven't seen the Saipan you've seen.
You can't see much from the Hyatt.
An excerpt of Brian Russ's piece in 1998, chief investigative correspondent for ABC News. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Brian Russ.
Good to be here this morning.
Well, you did that piece, more than 7 years ago. Your response now?
Well, it's interesting to watch it unfold because the man behind the scenes in every case was Jack Abramoff. We had footage we had on World News Tonight last night showing a delay arriving in Saipan. He's wearing a funny-colored floral hat, and he's greeted by a man in a beard who's Jack Abramoff. Big bear hugs all around, and it was Abramoff then who shepherded him around the island, made sure to see what he wanted to see, and DeLay took his family along. It was New Year's Eve. Temperatures are very nice, much nicer than back in the States, and that's what Abramoff was able to achieve. DeLay then became active in blocking legislation that would have cracked down on some of those terrible labor practices in Saipan.
I want to go to the issue of forced abortion, which is astounding given Tom DeLay's stand on abortion. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's completely counter to anything that DeLay or most Republicans seem to espouse. And that was on that island, there were forced abortions. And the workers there, who were all young women who often had to pay to get these jobs, knew the rules. And they were barred from having boyfriends and certainly barred from having children if they became pregnant. They knew where to go, and there were a few essential back alley abortion mills on the island, and that's where these young Chinese women went in order to keep their jobs. And that was the deal, and that's part of the situation that was essentially endorsed by DeLay when he fought the laws. The laws were established essentially exempting Saipan, although it is a U.S. territory, from U.S. labor laws.
So, of course, the clothing that is made there says made in the USA.
Exactly right. They have the exemptions of Made in the USA, Ralph Lauren, Tommy Hilfiger, all the major brands had garment factories there, owned primarily by Chinese industrialists from Hong Kong who brought in Chinese material, and the Chinese workers who lived in something akin to, I don't want to call it a labor camp, but it was surrounded by barbed wire. They were taken on the backs of trucks to these factories. They worked 10, 12 hours a day and then brought back to their camps. An ugly scene there, but one that was defended effectively by the garment manufacturers and by the government of Saipan at the time with the expenditure of millions of dollars on Jack Abramoff.
You talk about how in a memo that ABC News got that Abramoff wrote to his law firm, Preston Gates Ellis and Revelis Meads at the time, that was paid $1.36 million by Saipan officials, said such congressional trips, talking about Tom DeLay, are one of the most effective ways to build permanent friends on the Hill.
Exactly what they did. And of course, Abramoff has now admitted that he used these trips as ways essentially of providing favors to congressmen who in return would do favors for him on Capitol Hill. And it's not just Saipan, of course, other trips to Scotland, to Moscow, to Paris, all around the world. Abramoff was a very friendly travel agent for members of Congress who wanted to go somewhere.
And if you could explain one more time what Tom DeLay accomplished for the Saipan manufacturers who were, paying Jack Abramoff.
Essentially what he accomplished was to stop legislation, which is easier to do than to get it through. He was able to block legislation that would have changed the labor and immigration laws in Saipan and made it illegal to have these kinds of contracts. You couldn't have a contract like that in Los Angeles or any place else in the United States where the flag flies, but you could in Saipan. That was the loophole that they were trying to close under the Clinton administration. And in fact, when people at the Department of Interior attempted to do that, DeLay actually tried to introduce a bill to cut off funding for that particular section of the Department of Interior to stop them from essentially backing the workers' claims. And it became an ugly situation on Capitol Hill, and DeLay and others, but DeLay in particular, were involved in blocking the legislation and making sure that that status quo continued on Saipan.
Brian Russ, I want to thank you very much for being with us, chief investigative correspondent for ABC News. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to email us, you can write mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Anna Noguera, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. If you'd like to read a transcript or see the video or hear the audio of this program, we are podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.